Would you turn to Acts 7, please? Stephen, as he spoke before the high priest and the men of his day in defense of his stand for the Lord, reviewed the history of Israel, and he did a very wonderful job, as you know. I'd like to refer to just a few verses, though. If you'll look at verse 18 of chapter 7 of Acts. Till another king arose, which knew not Joseph, the same dealt subtly with our kindred and entreated our fathers, and evil entreated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children to the end that they might not live. In which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair. Now the word there in the Greek is fair to God, was fair to God, and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds and in deeds. And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel, and so on and so forth. Now, I won't read any more because we'll be reading it in the direct account in Exodus. Now go to Hebrews 11, if you will, please. And our passage tonight begins with verse 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. And then through faith he kept the Passover in the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Now my subject tonight is the faith of Moses' parents. As you see in verse 23, it says, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid of his parents. And then by faith Moses himself in 24 did what he did. But ere we look at this passage, I'd like you to see some slides, some of which were taken in Egypt. And I'd just like you to see them for a very definite reason. So, if you'd turn that on for me, please. And I'll sit down here. So you can see, now, this is, of course, the Nile River. And the valley there is that fertile area along which the Egyptians actually live. They don't live very far from the Nile itself, because that's their source of income, as it overflows and wheat is, of course, harvested. Now, during thousands of years, this was true, so that Egypt was considered the breadbasket of the ancient world. And those who came from the north, up in the Fertile Crescent, as it was called, came down to Egypt to get their supplies of grain. And storehouses were built, even as they were at the time of Joseph. And then it was sold from Egypt. Now, they were great in their architecture. You can't get the scale from this picture, but you will the next. But notice the columns there. Notice the capitals of the columns. Now, we're familiar with Greek architecture more than Egyptian, with the Ionic and the Doric and the Corinthian capitals. And then the shafts that are fluted. But these were built more sturdily, and they represented the lily at the top there in their capital. But notice the heavy stones above. And to give you an idea of the scale of the thing, look at the man on the left side there. Now imagine these people, the knowledge they had and the skill that they had, not only to shape these things, but to put those stones up on the top there that re- run along like beams at the top of the column. And their skill was tremendous, and their knowledge was tremendous. And this is the Egypt into which Moses entered. Here are gods of Egypt, but just to show you how they could carve. Now, these figures aren't carved this way because they couldn't do any better, but they did it because they wanted to do it like this, and they would stylize in their drawings and also in their carvings. But notice how clean the lines are, and these are from buildings that are maybe 3,000 years old. Because the Pharaoh decided that he was going to build, and he wrote that he would build to last for millions of years. Of course, he didn't know exactly what he was saying, but he certainly built to last a long time. And these are figures of gods in between the columns there, which they worshipped. That went backwards, didn't it? Close up of them, and there's a man in the foreground again. You can see the height of the figures. Once again, the figures are stylized. They've done this purposely. Another scene of the same thing. Now, this is one of the courtyards, and you see the multitude of gods that the people walk past as they want to worship. God after God. That's why when Moses said that the Lord God has sent me, they said, who is he? What is his name? They knew so many gods that the children of Israel didn't know who the Lord God was. So he said, well, I am that I am sent me. Now, this is their chief god, Ammon. And this figure was made entirely of gold. You can see it's a little more realistic. But the people came to worship this daily with fabulous processions. They would dress him and they would offer incense to him, present food to him. The priests had to be thoroughly bathed. They shaved their bodies entirely before they came in to see this god. And they served them. And this is the gods that Moses knew and heard about as far as the Egyptians were concerned. You've seen something like this in Paris. We have something like this in Washington, D.C., don't we? But this is where they offered honey, incense, bulls and goats and things like this before this emblem here. And Moses again saw this. Here's an altar with one of their beetles on top, that it was considered a god. The spirit of the god took any form he wanted. And here he took the form of looks like a calf or a goat. I don't know what it is. But he would enter into that, and of course they worshiped that. They didn't know how accurate they were, because behind every idol we know that there is a demon. Once again, you can see the processions would move through these colonnades of idols and up to various stages until they got into the temple, which was carved out of that mountain in the back, carved out of solid stone. Now imagine doing that without the tools that we have today. With hydraulic tools, it would be a tremendous job. But they were able to do this because of their skill. This is an actual picture. The other was a model. Because of their skill and ability. And so Moses knew all this, as we read. This is one of the queens. Of course, she's been defaced a bit, as you can see, but she was considered a goddess. Here's another one, Horus, H-O-R-U-S, who is called the hawk god. Now, this represents Israel, of course, being forced to labor in building. Now, when Abraham was in Ur of Chaldees, Egypt was 2,000 years old, with a history of 2,000 years. And so you can see the tremendous history that was behind Egypt. But then the Israelites were captured, were taken and made slaves, as you know, and they had to serve very rigorously until, even in their carvings, you can see they have a man here beating a slave. So it's not fanciful at all, as the Bible says. Until Moses came along and was discovered as God would have him to be. And he wept, and the princess felt sorry for him and made him to be her son. As we saw, they think that this might be the princess who found him. They're not sure, of course, but she is a princess here. That type of dress is typical. Moses would have walked these colonnades. He would have seen places like this, and only in the pomp as a prince. And of course he had servants and all that came with it. He would have walked the course of these areas too, and knew them. This was a pharaoh and his wife. And of course, they were considered gods and goddesses. And Moses knew this type of person well because he was such a person. He was being groomed for such a job. Here's one that you can see the realism of this and the skill that they've used. And that's gold. That's gold that's overlaying that face. And so when God speaks about Moses giving up something, he gave up something truly as far as the earth was concerned. He would have been fabulously rich and had servants at his beck and call. But here he's represented as the one who didn't fear Pharaoh, but stands before him to demand that the people of Israel be let go. And I think this so well ties in with the pictures and what we'll have to say. Love not the world, merely the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. Now let's look at our passage. Now notice verse 23, if you will. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw that he was a proper child. And they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Would you turn back into Exodus now? And we'll look just briefly there at Exodus, the first chapter. Verses 15 and 16. I'm going to move through it rapidly because I know you're familiar with it. But the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. Now, lesson number one. If the government of a country commands us to do that which is contrary to the word of God, we refuse to do it. If we are told to defy what God has told us definitely to do, then we refuse to do it, as did these women. And they were justified in it, because notice what it says in verse 20. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multitude and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass because the midwives feared God that he made them houses. And so God honored their faith. And this is a principle that we may have to face in future days if we don't even have to face it now. But the principle is, if God commands us to do something, and someone commands us to do that which is contrary to the will of God, then we refuse to do it. And this is exactly what the midwives did. They did it in a tricky manner, but nevertheless they did it. And so then, having failed in this area, notice verse 22, and the people, and Pharaoh charged all his people. Now I take that to mean not only the Egyptians, but the Hebrew people, because in Acts 7 it implies that the Hebrews were casting out their children to die too. But apparently his people, it says specifically, saying, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. And there went a man of the house of Levi, and took a wife, a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. Now it said in Hebrews, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child. And here it says, they saw he was a goodly child. He was a child that was that God thought was lovely, as we saw in Acts. Now, this to me, again, is a very significant thing. They saw that the child was a proper child, a goodly child. And I think this speaks to us who are parents and those of us who shall be parents. That those who are born to us, those children that are born to us, should be goodly, should be proper in our eyes. They should be of such a quality to us that we love them and would spare them. Now, you say, well, what do you mean by that exactly? Well, I mean this. Just as Pharaoh, who represents Satan and his activities, the one who knew not God, who defied God, and Satan, who is called a murderer and a liar from the very beginning, would take our children and he would slay them. Now, I say this as definitely as I can. He would slay them. The Lord Jesus Christ places upon a man a tremendous value, a value that men don't consider themselves to have, because he says, what if we gain the whole world and lose our own soul? What are we profited? And men don't think like this. They sell their souls and their lives, and the word is the same in the Greek, soul and life. They sell them for naught. They sell them for a pitiful bit of pleasure. They sell them for something that they can get out of this life that lasts but a moment, as it were. And even if it lasts 50 years, what is that in comparison to eternity? And they're willing to sell themselves for this. But Moses' parents were of such caliber, and they thought so much of their son when he was born, and saw such value in him, that they defied Pharaoh. And they hid their son. Now, once again, this speaks to me that God would have us look upon our children, and you who have not children but shall have them someday, that we should look upon our children as being of infinite worth, and we should defy Satan and defy the system that he has established, just as Pharaoh had a system in Egypt, and defy this and say, I will hide my child from this one. And I will hide him so that he cannot be killed. Now, this requires action on our part, and a very definite action, because as we experience God and as we get to know him, there's established in our thought pattern certain principles that we believe to be of God. We say within our own hearts, now, as a Christian, this thing should not be practiced. As a Christian, I discern that this is of the world, and this is totally of Satan. And as subtle as it may be, it is still of Satan. And because it is of Satan, we say, I recognize it as such, and I will hide my child from this. And this is what we must do. We must have this kind of godly discernment that they had. Because they loved and saw this child to be a proper child, we should take this attitude toward our children. Now, it doesn't matter what the child thinks particularly, and I say this with due regard to the thoughts of youth. I respect youth, and I respect children, but I also realize this, that because of lack of experience, because of a lack of knowledge, our children are unable to choose a proper path. And Satan, if he can deceive us in our maturity because of his ability and his wisdom, how much more can he take an innocent young child and deceive that child? It is our responsibility to direct our children and hide them, as it were, from Pharaoh, lest he slay them. And the death that he brings is far worse than the death that was brought to those children, because those children were entered into heaven. But those who are caught up in Satan's snare, their lives are ruined, and sometimes they're lost for eternity because of it. So it becomes our responsibility to have the same sort of vision as did these parents. Now, they did it in faith. They did it in faith. We have to say, well, this is God's will, therefore I will do it. And we have to command our children. We have to tell them what they must do. and direct their paths as we see they should be directed, and not permit the child to choose his own way. Now, in the second chapter, it tells us of Exodus here. It tells us that she hid him for 3 months. She hid him as long as she could, as long as it was within her power and the parents' power to control this child's life, she did. But there came a time when she could no longer control it. There comes a time when children leave our homes. They are no longer under our control, at given times even. A child goes off to school. He goes off to a school where things are taught that should not be taught. He has relationships with other fellows and girls that have no Christian background and in whom Satan has sway. All right, now, so what does she do? She, of course, builds this arc of bulrushes and pitches within and out, and she commends it to the reeds, but I'm sure that she commended this child to God. There's no doubt in my mind. If she could, by faith, do the one, she certainly did the other. And when our children leave our homes, whether it be for school, or whether it be for work as they grow older, or whether it be for lives to be lived by themselves, yet we can commend them to God and say, Lord, you take over now. I hid them while I could. I protected them while I could. Now you protect them. Now, you say, is such faith honored? I believe that definitely it is honored. And you know why I believe it, in part? Because our next verse in Hebrews says that by faith Moses did certain things. And you see, the faith that was reflected in the parent, because the parents were faithful to God and did what they could when they could do it, then God says, all right, now, that same faith has been built in Moses, and not only in Moses, but in Miriam as well, and Aaron as well. So that you see the whole family caught up in the same thing. And by faith, then Moses begins to act as he becomes mature. Now it says that they were not afraid of the king's command. And I'll read it to you. It's Hebrews 11:23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw that he was a proper child. And they were not afraid of the king's command. Now we say Satan doesn't command. If this is a type of Satan, he doesn't command, but he does. And he commands in a very subtle way. He would say to us, ruin your child's life. But he doesn't say it that way. I remember when I was working downtown, I used to go into Stobie for photostats. And there was a lady there who had gotten saved at a Pentecostal church. I think she was born again. And conversing with her, it seemed that she really knew the Lord. And she went on for the Lord for a while, but of course she was all hepped up on the emotional side of things, and this kind of peters out after a while, you know, if it's all emotion. And so one day she said to me, do you think it is right for me to let my daughter to go to a dancing school? And I said, I don't think it's right. And she says, well, I do think it's right. She says, because if I don't do it, she said, then my daughter will not be graceful when she grows up. And she was perfectly serious. She thought that this would add such grace and such carriage to her daughter that, of course, she could make a better way in life and perhaps attract a husband. I don't know what her idea was, but this is what she said to me. So I see then this possibility that Satan can so suggest that we become afraid not to do certain things for our children because he puts us into such pressure and under such circumstances that the logical thing seems to be to do what he would suggest and what would be of the world. But these parents feared not what Pharaoh had to say. And what we have to do is turn in faith to God and say, I don't care what seems logical in the human mind, and I don't care what society says, and I don't actually care what my kids say particularly. It's what God says. And no matter how Satan attacks, in what area he attacks, to be able to say no. I don't fear what you suggest, Satan. I'm going to do what God has told me to do. And in faith they did this. And they feared not the king's command. And this should be our attitude. to just stand for what we know to be the truth of God, regardless of what anybody says, and pursue this, and fear not to take this stand. Now go to back to Hebrews 11, if you will. You can keep your hand in Exodus, if you will. I might want to turn back there. Not immediately, but soon. Verse 24, the same faith is reflected in Moses now. Because it says, by faith Moses, when he was come to years, and we saw in Acts that he was come to 40 years of age. It wasn't to 21 years, as we say to years, but 40 years of age. And when he was come to years, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, in the Greek it says he refused to acknowledge that he was. It was a question of him actually denying this thing. He refused to acknowledge that he was Pharaoh's daughter's son. And he took a definite stand. And when he did that, we can see something of what he refused when we saw what was on the pictures there. He refused the position that could have been had his because he was trained in all the knowledge of and wisdom of Egypt, we're taught. He was brought up as an actual prince. The knowledge of the Egyptians, as far as mathematics was concerned, was tremendous, as we know today. Their ability to build amazes us. We don't know how they did it. We still don't know how they made the pyramids, but they did it. And these things have stood and stood. And the wealth of that land was tremendous because, as I said, it was the breadbasket of the ancient world. Money poured into that. And here was Moses in a position where he was a ruler and was groomed for this position. So he refused power and he refused position and he refused fame and he refused wealth and he refused the future as far as he was concerned. And he refused the adoration of his people and the service of his slaves. He refused all this. And when he says he refused something tremendous. It was no light thought that he had because he had so much to refuse. But look at what it says in verse 25. And he choosing rather. So that here was a choice entered in. And the idea is this, that if I have this, I cannot have that. And so I choose this rather than that. And what he was choosing was to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Now this is required in our lives. We have, as it were, the domain of Satan about us, the Pharaoh of our land spiritually, of our existence spiritually. As natural human beings, we have all that Egypt has to offer. And Satan can make it very, very attractive. And he doesn't cease. When we make a decision when we're 8 years old, if we would, he'll come to us when we're 10 with something new. And when we make a decision at 12 and say, I want to live for God, when we get to be 15, he puts new pressures on in different areas. And when we get to be 21, then he puts on pressures in another area. And when we become married, then he puts on pressures in another area. And it's a continual thing. So that we have to choose this rather than that. And it constantly becomes what he had to do. He could make a single choice in this given area, but then after that he had to continue to choose for God, of course, as he did. But he chose rather to suffer affliction. Now the two words there are very, very unhappy words. To suffer is not a very pleasant word. Affliction is not a very pleasant word. While it says with the people of God then to enjoy the pleasures, which is a pleasant word. And enjoy is a pleasant word. And rather than choosing these things, to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. Now, in our lives, it comes to us in little steps. Ordinarily, there aren't big choices like this. There may be given choices at a certain time. This man, Peterson, I understand, who writes so many of our new hymns, had written a hymn that was of such a caliber that someone wanted to purchase it, and I'm sure that I'm not exaggerating when I say $50,000 was offered him if he would sell them the music and all the words except strike out that which referred to the Lord, and they were going to put in a girl's name there because it was speaking about adoration and love and things like this for this person. And he said, I'll give you an answer in a day or two. And when he considered it, before the Lord, he had to say to them, no, I don't want what you have to offer. I'm going to sing my songs for Jesus Christ. I'm going to write for him and not for you. And it was a fabulous song just to say, well, you can have this single one. I'll write some more for the Lord. He could have said this and reasoned thus, but he made a choice. Now, most of our choices are minor in a sense. They're little things. They're subtle things. It's saying, I reckon myself to be dead indeed unto sin. This type of choice is the choice that we make. And it comes to us as sin moves into our area and we're conscious of temptation to be able to say, I choose rather. You see. Rather than to have the pleasure of this sin for a season, I choose to suffer affliction, whatever it costs me, to pursue the things of God. Now, there's always, in the pleasures of sin, there's always payday. I think of, what's his name, Hugh Hefner, who edits Playboy and is the editor and owner of it. And he remarked in one of his articles, he says, I'm having my fun now, but there's going to be a payday later. And it's true. And we can have the pleasures of sin and very much pleasure in sin for a season. But there's to be a payday. And God says, because it's just for a season, choose rather. And Moses saw this. He saw what he could have had in Egypt. He realized this full well. He was educated to realize it full well. He knew the service that could have been his. And he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. And this becomes our choice. To choose to be with the people of God. To choose to take the stand that God would have us with his people. And all they that live godly shall suffer persecution. We have to suffer afflictions if we're going to choose to live for God. Moses did it. And God holds him up as an example of faith. And we're to do the same. Now, can we come to such years as did he? Can we refuse to be called anything that would be associated with Satan? Anything that is set up in his system, no matter how attractive it is, and say, I would rather suffer loss. I would rather suffer affliction than to have the pleasures of sin for a season. Now, this is what it comes to. And notice what the determining factor was in verse 26. It says he was esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. Now, there were treasures in Egypt. This isn't vain talk. But he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. For he had recompense unto... He had respect unto the recompense of reward. Now, he could have had Pharaoh's wealth and all those treasures immediately to be his at a given time. But he chose rather, because of the greater riches that he found in Christ and for the recompense of the reward, than to choose to have those things for a little while. Now, if you look at Romans 8, just turn over to Romans 8. I'd like you to see something. Romans, the 8th chapter. And this is just a hint of what God has for us. He doesn't say too much. Verse But look at verse 18. Or we can start with 17. If we're children, then heirs. Children of God, then we're heirs. Not heirs of Pharaoh or of Satan's world, but heirs of God. And joint heirs with Christ. Now he is to inherit all things. Everything we are told is summed up in Jesus Christ. The whole of the universe will end up under his control, as it is not now. It will end up as his inheritance to do with it as he will. Now that's what we know. But the things that we don't know are also his, because the things in heaven are reconciled unto him. All things, whether they're in heaven or on earth, are to be reconciled in him. They're to find their consummation in Jesus Christ. He's to inherit all things. And whatever that new creation is, and the scope and magnitude of it, whatever the extent of that is all going to be his. Because he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And God says, now look it. I would like you to share as an heir with him. Now Moses caught this vision. God must have given him a special revelation to understand this. But he chose this rather than the treasures of Egypt, which were so tremendous in our eyes. Yet he took and looked on those and said, I'd rather have Christ. And I have respect unto the recompense of reward that is there. Now notice also that it says in verse 17, if so be that we suffer with him, choosing rather to suffer the afflictions with the people of God, that we may be also glorified together. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. And then observe, for the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. And God says that creation itself, that the creatures themselves wait for something. They wait for the manifestation, the display, the actual displaying of those who are sons of God. For this reason, that the whole creation waits, and just as men within their hearts have a longing for a utopia. Men would like to have a city in which there was justice, exercise, deep down in their hearts. They would have a city in which they could safely walk the streets of that city. They would like to have a city where their little ones, if they have any care for their little ones, would be safe from evil men and evil doctrines and everything else. They would like to have a country because within the very soul of man there arises a patriotism, and unless it's squelched, they have a patriotism for their country. As we know. But this is a desire that can only be expressed and find its full fulfillment as it extends towards that which is eternal and which is of God. And so the whole creation groans for something. They long for something. And they try this and they try that and they find no satisfaction. And they finally get to the place where they are in absolute despair if they think at all. And they say, it's not worth anything at all. I don't know why I live. I exist. But what's the end of it all? And God says, the whole creation groans, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. Because when that takes place, then God will fulfill his plan for men. And mankind as it has never been fulfilled. The millennium will be ushered in, and Christ will reign, and we'll have heaven on earth almost. But then God says, look beyond that. There's a future state. And God says, I have it for you. And all men, if they but knew, would look and grasp for this, if they but had the vision of faith. But Moses caught it. And God would have us to catch it. Because it says here that in verse 20, for the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly. but by reason of him who has subjected the same in hope, because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. And then, of course, it goes on to show that we shall have that redemption of our body in verse 23. And this is for what we wait, and this is for what we hope. Now, 2 Corinthians, please, if you will, just to develop it just a little more, the fourth chapter. And notice the contrast once again. Verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4:16. For which cause we faint not. We go after these things, and though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, are for time, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Now this is what God would have us to do. He would have us to be like Moses and say, well, by faith, that I will say no to Pharaoh. I will say no to his Egypt. And I will say yes to Jesus Christ, and whatever it costs me, I will say yes to that. Because I have respect unto the recompense of reward. There is an eternal weight of glory, tremendous words, the exceeding and eternal weight of glory that God holds up in truth before us, not as a lie, not as Satan, who holds up a bubble and we grasp it and it's gone. And he says that he gives us a clue. He says, while we look not at the things which are seen, not at what Satan has to offer us, that we can touch and taste and hear and handle, and the things that seem so near and real to us. He says, this is not it. He says, this is but for time. He says, it's those things that are unseen that you have to take as Moses did by faith, that are eternal. He says, now choose. Now Moses did it. And God holds them up, and may we be the same, to choose those things by faith that are eternal and that are of Christ.